Did I hear you correctly when you testified that even if we were to pass the amendment and the statutory regime would be certified by the Secretary of Interior, we would not be regaining management of our game? Is that what you said?
Mr. Chairman, if one examines the language of the so-called Stevens Amendment, it right now would prohibit the implementation or enforcement of any final rule, regulation, or policy pursuant to Title 8 of ANILCA to manage and to assert jurisdiction, authority, or control over land, water, and wildlife in Alaska for subsistence uses, except, and then there's a list here. The particular rules being referred to here are those that deal with the expanded management on navigable waters and extra territorial lands within the state. My understanding is that the Secretary's view is that they would continue to enforce that which they are enforcing today. This act would preclude them from expanding that jurisdiction. If by midnight Thursday he certifies that you have previously acted, and that our next step will be the enactment of laws consistent with such an amendment, which is what will take, what steps would be necessary to have the Secretary effectively give up the authority he is currently existing on federal lands, public lands in the state.
So if we followed through with the statutory changes, then we would look forward to getting the return of game management?
That's correct.
Okay, sorry. But yeah, because that troubled me greatly. Yeah. I'm not sure I understood. I understand the context which you said it, but I jumped to the assumption that we would not get the return, even if we jumped through all the hoops, as Representative James mentioned. The difficulty thereof. Okay. Mr. Attorney General, if I could direct your attention to page 1, line 16. I know you don't like the whole sentence, but the last three words of it, all beneficial uses, I think I've got some problems with that because of the way I understand how our existing statutes work and the regime we have in the state for implementing Tier 2 and what would be Tier 1 if it was legal. Because this says the preference couldn't be granted unless there was not sufficient game for all beneficial uses. Well, isn't subsistence a beneficial use?
Mr. Chairman, it is indeed.
Right. So I think this... Wouldn't it be more appropriate to have something like delete those and say something like the customary and traditional level of subsistence use? Because isn't the customary and traditional level the tripwire in our subsistence law currently? Or if you can't satisfy that, then you have to go to Tier 1 or subsistence? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is true, although it's not clear to me. It's not a tripwire for commercial sport or personal use, if I've understood your question correctly. I mean, I think I have to confess I'm notoriously slow when it comes to hearing suggestions and trying to respond. Is much more visual than I am oral, as it were. Looks like you have some language. Nice to meet you.
You're right, Bob.
Mr. Chairman, could I suggest that perhaps we would continue any other questions and then a possible break where I'd have a chance to look at this and perhaps come back?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a good idea.
Did that conclude your questioning?
Yes.
Representative Williams.
Thank you. I think you, Andy, asked a question and it made it very clear.
Excuse me, Representative Williams, could you get closer to the mic so we can all hear you?
Yeah, please let me sit there. Representative Helcoro asked the question I was going to ask, and it was very clear to me that that portion of Section C on page 2 is very open anytime anybody would, the governor got upset at whatever, or not upset, but just thought that he could do that. That's fine. This is, you know, this has been, that whole area talks about going to court and this sort. What, tell me, what did the state of Alaska do when it dropped the Babbitt case, and what can the state of Alaska do to try to take care of all the court cases that are going to come about once one way or the other on this constitutional amendment, if it isn't written correctly or isn't up a court going according to ANILCA?
Mr. Chairman, if I, there are actually a couple of questions there. First, with the State v. Babbitt was actually consolidated with the Katie John case. There were really two issues. One had to do with the geographic reach of ANILCA, and that was the Katie John case itself, and where the court, contrary to the position of the state of Alaska, concluded that it extended into the navigable waters of the state. The Babbitt portion of the lawsuit had to do with whether the Secretary of Interior and the Secretary of Agriculture could adopt regulations implementing Title VIII. And the state brought that action, lost at the district court level, I would say very understandably so. And that was what then at the beginning of the Knowles administration was dropped on appeal. Judgment that was both legal and political. Legal from the standpoint that there was little, if any, likelihood that the state would prevail on the theory that somehow the secretary couldn't adopt regulations to manage federal lands. And political from the standpoint that it was seen as an affront to a portion of the state citizenry. So that in essence was the Babbitt decision, again part of a bigger package. I'm not sure, Representative Williams, whether I've understood the second portion of your question in terms of what the state could do.
I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of lawsuits one way or the other if and when we pass a constitutional amendment. How could we address those if there was a chance to do it prior to, or without going to? I'm sure that if we don't pass an amendment that is consistent with ANILCA, whichever way it is, one side or the other is going to take us to court. Can the state intervene in any portion of that?
Mr. Chairman, if there are three or four scenarios. First, there might be a challenge directly to ANILCA Title VIII itself. That could happen today. Mm-hmm. there's surely an aggrieved hunter in Anchorage or Palmer or Fairbanks who has traditionally hunted in some part of rural Alaska, who would feel aggrieved that he or she today cannot hunt in those areas for subsistence purposes. And that person satisfies, I think, the standing requirement in a federal case, in a federal court, challenge an Elkin. Now, why that hasn't happened, I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. It's clear that in terms of now two cases that have dealt with standing issues involving the legislature, that the legislature will not get there. The federal court on its own, in terms of standing, under the current state of Alaska law. Now, whether a constitutional amendment conferring it would help cure that infirmity, I'm less sure of. My sense is that it probably would. A second point of challenge, the constitutional amendment itself, the state invariably becomes a defendant in that situation. That is, someone claims that the constitutional amendment is in the nature of a revision, not an amendment, and the state will defend the actions of this body to place it on the ballot. If at some later point someone were to file a lawsuit and claim that the statutes enacted under it are unconstitutional for federal reasons, for example, that the state grants through the constitutional amendment and the corresponding legislation violated federal equal protection law, that is rural preference over urban, the state of Alaska again would defend that in court. We would be a party. But I guess those are three scenarios that I see are all likely scenarios in court.
Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on the questions of Representative Williams, it seems to me, you know, with the Submerged Lands Act and the rights that we as a state have to manage our submerged lands and navigable waters, it seems to me that this is a state's rights issue, not because Anelka said so, but because the court said so, and I believe they were wrong in that issue. In state's rights issues, the governor has a right to go directly to the Supreme Court to get a decision on that issue or those issues. And it seems to me appropriate for that to happen. Is that an issue that is precluded from the dismissal of the Babbitt case with prejudice?
Mr. Chairman, again, the Babbitt case, I think, has been misunderstood and overblown as to what was being sought in the way of a remedy. It was not a challenge to the constitutionality of Anelka. It was a simple challenge to the power of the Secretary to enact regulations. So it's first of all, has very limited effect. I think second, with regard to the question, can the governor go directly to the U.S. Supreme Court? The Supreme Court does have original jurisdiction on cases and controversies. Since 1961, there have probably been about 115 applications for the court to take original jurisdiction. And there's a much higher batting average for the court to actually take those cases, a higher batting average than the normal petition for cert. it's probably is up as high as 40% of those cases. But of those that have been granted since 1961, almost all of them have involved specifically, and Alaska has had two cases in that category, have involved boundary disputes either between states or between a state and the federal government. And I'm only aware of one right off that didn't fall in that kind of category, and that had to do with a challenge to Civil Rights Act of 1964. And I think it was either North or South Carolina against then Attorney General Katzenbach. So that avenue is not a particularly likely one. Just looking at how the courts, how the Supreme Court has actually dealt with petitions, this is not the place to indicate or announce a particular action, but I would say stay tuned in the next couple of weeks on another matter that where we intend to move in that direction. But I would say that and I would agree with you that it is a matter of states' rights, and the Katie John case has been matched by a decision of the Alaska Supreme Court in the Totemoff case, which concluded that the state had the power to regulate, that this was not a matter for federal jurisdiction. So we have a situation where we have a Ninth Circuit decision where petition for cert was denied and an Alaska Supreme Court decision that reaches a contrary conclusion, and they're both entitled to equal weight.
And then just on that point, however, that if it were the thing to do to take a case to the Supreme Court on the issue of the submerged lands and navigable waters and the dispute that we have with the federal government over that issue, would that case not be ripe until such time as they actually took over, which they haven't done at this point in time? As soon as they start to manage in our waters, wouldn't that be then time ripe for that case?
Mr. Chairman, it would create issues of ripeness. I think that the most likely outcome were such a challenge to be mounted. I'll just score the conjunctive there. That the Supreme Court would refer it back to a district court for findings, that we would be looking at protracted litigation. And I guess, again, my judgment is we don't have to engage in that at all. If we pass a simple constitutional amendment, we're not faced with that issue. And we're not faced with the possibility that we lose, as we have lost up to now in the federal courts on that very issue.
Thank you, but I don't agree that it's simple.
It's difficult, but the solution is simple.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Williams.
On that issue, the outdoor council wants to go to court. There's been a push, the push to go to court. What can the state of Alaska do to satisfy that? Is there a chance? I don't know exactly what they want to do, but we're going to be fighting this issue all the time. I'm sure we can't keep anybody out of court.
Mr. Chairman, the one thing I cannot predict, as much as I know lots of people would like to get finality to the question of whether ANILCA is constitutional or not, it's quite possible that one would never get that answer. It would never get to that question. We have some indications. I mean, we've had the problems with standing, and certainly the legislature's encountered that twice now in litigation over some aspect of subsistence. We've had the problem that until the feds have taken over with its regs, that it's not ripe. But we also have a district court decision from the D.C. District Court. Later, that portion, in essence, vacated by the D.C. Circuit, that says standing is fine here, I'm going to reach the merits here. I'm going to reach the statute of limitations argument, not the merits. It's too late. Someone who's going to challenge on its face Title VIII and its constitutionality on the basis that it has a rural preference had 6 years under federal statute of limitations to do so. 1986, it's too late. Now, what happened at the Court of Appeals was to say, Judge Robinson, you shouldn't have reached that question. Because the people you had in front of your court had no right to be there. And in federal court, standing is a jurisdictional issue. If you don't have standing, you court don't have the discretion to go to the next issue. The party is out. It's over. I don't know that that judge is right on the statute of limitations issue, but there have been two other McDowell cases that have been tried and haven't gotten anywhere in the Ninth Circuit. I assume that was part of the reason of the recommendation that you go to the only other circuit available to you, which was the D.C. Circuit, and it hasn't been all that much more helpful. I can't craft or I can't suggest that litigation is going to give the kind of finality in the sense of the answer, is it constitutional or not? It may be that that window has been closed for a long time. That's what the judge has said, and he's gotten his wrist slapped for having gone that far. I mean, for answering a question he shouldn't have gotten to. But I think that's some indication. I don't think there's anything that the state does that's going to improve that. If the statute of limitations issue is rightly decided, was rightly decided, there's nothing this state, whether it's the legislature through a constitutional amendment or the governor with existing power, could do to change that. But this governor's made clear he's not going to challenge, in any case, the constitutionality of Title VIII.
Representative Williams.
I guess, you know, because this has been one area, you know, I've talked to several people and I've tried to understand what the opposition to, I tried to understand the opposition stand on voting no on a constitutional amendment. And it always came right down to it's unconstitutional. And I will only listen to the Supreme Court of these United States. I would like, you know, because we're going to go there, I'm sure, you know. I certainly don't want to get in the position of turning over the management of the state of Alaska to the feds. If there was a way that we can negotiate and say, well, okay, the state of, and I understand how the governor feels about this and how he, I'd like to think I do anyway. But I don't know if there was a chance that we could go to court and get this finalized one way or the other. It sure was finalized when we went to court with the Kate and Peter John, the sovereignty issue.
Being a time.
You know, that was several years past.
Mr. Chairman, one of the powers that resides with the governor is to bring suits in the name of the state, and he gets to make that call. And he has profound views on this subject that he will not be associated with any challenge that would disturb the rural priority, which he believes to be morally right, and it is on that plane. And I recognize there are others who feel very strongly with the same level of conviction and intensity that he does, who would like to see it litigated. This issue was an issue that came up during the course of the last election. The people of Alaska had a chance to choose between gubernatorial candidates who expressed their views on this. And this governor was elected, reelected, having heard considered this very issue most recently last year, that he is not going to, given his mandate and his beliefs, use his office to in any way lessen, reduce the impact of Title VIII, certainly not subjected in his name to challenge. It's just not a negotiable item. I don't think I can say it more emphatically.
Attorney General, since the governor is unwilling to challenge Title VIII, is there any way the legislature could acquire that standing?
Mr. Chairman, you're... I think that was a signal.
That was a signal. That was a five-minute warning, by the way. I'd like to recognize Representative Bundy over there.
Yeah, right.
And Representative Mulder.
Mr. Chairman, I see that... your proposed section 2 at lines on page 2, lines 22 to 26, attempt to do so. Again, I would simply point out that certainly confers authority, would confer authority for you all for state law purposes. Whether it will get you further in the federal court, I would just have, I would urge you to confer with federal practitioners.
Thank you. Further questions for the Attorney General? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman. Mr. Attorney General, what sort of timing do you foresee if by chance both bodies were to pass something similar to the governor's permissive language? What sort of time frame do you see as after that would be affected by the public? There's always a chance that it might, but let's say that the public also would pass that constitutional change. How much time then after that would you envision that before it would be out of compliance? I mean, it would take some time, obviously.
Mr. Chairman, my best judgment about that is through the next regular session.
Okay. And if I may, what would your feeling be if it was passed by the legislature and didn't pass, or didn't pass the electorate?
Mr. Chairman, if the constitutional amendment is voted down, the ball game is over, and the federal management not only continues at its current level, it will then expand into the waters.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Ontario.
Thank you. Mr. Attorney General, I just, sitting in the back, I wasn't sure if I heard. I think it was in response to a question from Representative James. As far as the legislature taking reasonable steps to address this issue, you felt there was the opportunity for the secretary to respond with reasonableness in kind. Right.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And in particular, that I would expect him to exercise his certification authority with reason within the time permitted.
Does that also mean possible amendments to ANILCA that he would deem to be reasonable?
Mr. Chairman, I understand that the Secretary, and only what I have heard on radio, has declared that, in his view, there would be no further ANILCA amendments while he is sitting as Secretary.
The other question is, the Constitution basically grants protections to minority groups, and in the state of Alaska, rural hunters and fishermen are a minority group. But in addition to that, urban hunters, when you're looking at the entire state population, are a minority group of the state population, I believe. When you indicated that the quickest way to solve the problem, the easiest way, is to pass the permissive language and let the legislature deal it with a simple vote of 21, that would be a significant erosion of that constitutional protection granted to that minority group in the state of Alaska, wouldn't it be?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that the Constitution specifically talks about protections for specific minority groups. I don't see any language that makes reference to minority rights. But I think more generally the question is, at least as a lawyer would look at it, in creating, differentiating classes of people or groups of people, and that there's a balancing that involves both the nature of the right, but also, again, looking at the purpose and looking at whether it's a rough cut is rationally supported. And I think that's both with respect to state law and federal law. Certainly, in a equal protection analysis, it's a little more refined than I've described it. But does what Congress has done in making the distinction between urban and rural have a rational basis in terms of public law? And I'd submit that it does. And I would encourage you to look at the purposes in this, particularly Section 801 of ANILCA, which tries to set out what its objectives are. I think it's a sound objective in trying to roughly cut, satisfy an objective that represents both concerns about culture, concerns about reliance on the resource, the availability or lack of it of other resources, and again making clear that it is not to the exclusion of all others. We have set up classes of people in a wide range of governmental activities or services that we provide. We have done so within our Constitution with respect to natural resources. A legislature, along with the support of the people, created a limited entry. And it's clear that there are some classes of people who were given access and others who weren't. And one would say today that it's largely now dictated by financial resources to be able to purchase a permit. But we do make rational decisions that distinguish between Alaskans. And we do not see that as fundamentally offensive. I would say that with respect to specific ones, and perhaps in this context, there are many who feel that it is repugnant. But for the most part, most of the services that we provide have criteria for their provision. We are willing to distinguish between old and young in terms of rights, between people who have levels of education and those who don't. We have made distinctions on the basis of geography with respect to how much we fund activities or the status of a local government. There's just a whole series of things that we have justified to distinguish between people, and the most that the law requires that there'd be at least a rational basis for it, and depending on how important that right is, be a compelling interest for doing so. And so I'm not offended at all, and I don't think the Constitution would be offended by provisions that would allow for rural preference.
And one final question on the issue of adding local residency to this constitutional language, would that then just allow the legislature through statute to determine rural residency is a type of local residency?
Mr. Chairman, local residency has a specific meaning actually in Title VIII, which is Tier 2, and which is really achieved by the words proximity in this. I think local residency is a very, very much narrower meaning than just place of residence or rural. Either way, it really is a description for a Tier 2, not a Tier 1.
And actually, I'm sorry, I think the discussion earlier was to the phrase place of residence.
Yes.
In place of residence, if you lived in rural Alaska, that could be that specific place of residence. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, place of residence would allow one to define rural. That's correct. What is rural, what isn't?
Mr. Attorney General, I've heard many during the testimony in the previous episode suggest that subsistence is a fundamental right. What would your reaction be to that statement?
Mr. Chairman, I do not believe in a legal sense that it is a fundamental right.
Further questions? Seeing none, Mr. Attorney General, I believe you were handed a copy of a proposed amendment by Representative Roper. I don't know if you've had time to peruse that yet, but it's
Mr. Chairman, I can assure you I have not.
But if you would, and it would be available to the committee at a later time, we'd appreciate it.
I would be delighted to do so.
Thank you. This time, the chair is going to take a 10-minute at ease. We've been going about 3 hours. I know many are looking for the room down the hall. We'll take 10 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Are we ready?
Nope.
I knew it was.
Juno, are we ready?
I knew it was. Well, they're safe.
Hundreds in attendance and thousands around the state. We'll call the next witness up.
Boy, I bet there's 600,000 people that wish we had this on the gavel to gavel.
Okay, the next witness, or testifier, I'd like to call up is a representative or representatives from Alaska Federation of Natives. Julie et al.
Et al. Julie Kitkisho.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity and the invitation to testify. For the record, my name is Julie Kitka. I'm president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. To my right is legal counsel for AFN, Norm Cohen. To my left is legal counsel of the AFN, Rick Agnew. And be pleased to answer any questions. I'll be brief. I have to tell you, you know, I've enjoyed listening to the Attorney General going through his briefing of the committee substitute. It was very helpful since we just got copies of it just as you all did right before the hearing started, so it was very helpful to hear his analysis of that. And I want to state for the record that we agree with much of what he has outlined. I do want to say, to begin with, I find it hard to believe that this committee would view this proposal as a serious proposal. And having spent Wednesday through Sunday here, and this to be where we're at on that, to me is very personally disappointing and sad for the people of Alaska. On behalf of AFN, I urge you not to approve the amendment in front of you because Based on our analysis of it, it will not bring the state into compliance with ANILCA. The Interior Department will not make the certifications required by federal law for an amendment which does not make a subsistence priority for rural residents for all renewable resources. This amendment is too limited to bring the state into compliance with ANILCA. The amendment is limited to only indigenous resources. It is limited to times of surplus, and it does not clearly state that rural residents qualify. Secondly, the Secretary of Interior has already indicated that a priority based on proximity to the resource does not meet the requirements of ANILCA. The standards used in this amendment are based on proximity to the resource, not rural or even place of residence. The amendment before us cannot achieve the goal of regaining state management. And why would AFN go on record supporting an amendment that's already been rejected by the Interior Department? And we wonder why the committee would be entertaining this at this point, already reviewing Interior's response. Thirdly, the amendment to us is confusing and places too many conditions in the Constitution. We feel that there should be a straightforward amendment to the Constitution that allows the legislature to give a subsistence priority to rural residents. That is the term that's been before the people. That's the term that people understand. We cannot put conditions on the priority. We place a conditional amendment before the people. We give Alaskans a false choice. They can vote for an amendment, but it places too many conditions on the priority. We feel the amendment will not work. It will not do the job because it has too many conditions relating to surplus, reasonable opportunity, indigenous subsistence resources, and so forth. Like I said, I would urge you to put aside this approach, as well as when you take a look at the other segments in your committee substitute in regard to the litigation, in regard to the shifting of power away from the governor to the legislature, just basically your fundamental shifts in power. I think that you're, again, in our view, going backwards as far as trying to find a resolution that should go before the voters. I also have to tell you, I'm quite shocked that some of this stuff in your Section 2 would be something that you would include in a constitutional amendment, even if you thought that that was a good policy choice that you wanted at the end. The thought that you would clutter up our Constitution with all this kind of stuff, as opposed to doing other ways, to me, is just surprising. Like I said, we had limited time to review this prior to the hearing, but our lawyers would be glad to answer any technical questions in regard to the amendment or our views on why or why not it may comply. I do want to state also for the record that AFN will not be supporting this constitutional amendment or anything similar to this. We will be awaiting information from the Secretary of Interior and their views on whether or not it complied, and urge the committee to ask for approval or pre-approval, similar to the governor did on his proposal, so that you'd know before you vote on something finally or before you put that out before the voters whether or not it in fact will help the state regain management, or whether or not you're just going down another path that won't regain management for you. So that's basically concludes our comments on the proposal before you. Once again, we think it's a step backwards. We think that it will not regain management for the state, and therefore we don't believe it. It's advised that it ought to advance out of this committee and move forward in the process when it won't accomplish the goals of regaining state management. It won't accomplish the goals of getting certification from the secretary. It won't accomplish what I believe that the special session was set out to do. And so that's the reason I'm saying that in our view it's a step backwards.
Julie, if you would look at the amendment on page 1, and just starting with line 10, which goes to the middle of line 13, where it says, and I'll read, and I make a few changes. The legislature may provide a preference to and among residents for a reasonable opportunity to take a subsistence resource on the basis of customary and traditional use direct dependence, place of residence, proximity to the resource, or the availability of the alternative resources. In what I have read there, is there anything that you would object to?
Well, I'd like to ask Norm Cohen to respond to that.
Mr. Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, the only point that I would raise is the question of reasonable opportunity. As stated in the letter from the regional solicitor, including reasonable opportunity in the constitutional amendment, they found to be inconsistent with what their charge is and what the Congress had requested that they certify, and they could not certify it with those two words there. Removal of those two words, and if I have correctly what you had stated the rest of it, I believe is pretty close to what we've been proposing.
If I might follow up, because we were just having a discussion about reasonable opportunity, and as I understand it, it is used in the state's rules, regulations currently. And in talking to the Attorney General, I found it difficult to determine what else you could do. It seems to me like reasonable opportunity is what you do, you know, that it's just assumed. I don't know why we need it or not need it in there, but there are some people who want it in there. And so that's why it's there. And I read the solicitor's opinion too on reasonable opportunity and his comments on that, but it seems to me like whether it's in the NILCA or not, it's presumed to be there because that's all you can offer is a reasonable opportunity. Would you just comment to that, please?
Mr. Chairman, the problem with reasonable opportunity is how it would be defined by statute and or how it had been previously defined by courts. When the state put reasonable opportunity into the statutes, it had already come out of compliance with ANILCA. I believe it was placed in the statutes at the 92 special session so that the federal ANILCA has never been, there has never been a question as to whether the state is in compliance with ANILCA by having reasonable opportunity in there, because the state had come out of compliance by the time it got placed in the statutes. So we've not had the situation where the state had it in between 1980 and 89 when the state was in compliance to test whether it would work or not. The test, the standard, is whether the regulations provide for the customary traditional uses that have been established by the people in question of a specific resource. And that's what the boards are supposed to do in terms of crafting regulations. Do they mirror, is the term we've been using, the customary traditional uses that have been established over time? If they do or they don't, it's a way you can test that. Reasonable opportunity can place a whole lot of different standards, or it could be that standard that I just stated. And so the problem with it undefined here is that you don't know what it means and why it's better to have that discussion left to statutory work later after a constitutional amendment is agreed upon.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, to follow up on that, Mr. Cohen, I thought I heard you say, and I may have heard incorrectly, but I thought you said that the solicitor's office had said that reasonable opportunity would cause it to not be in compliance. Is that correct?
That's my understanding of the letter, yes.
I'm wondering whether, in fact, there is a second letter from the solicitor. I think we all have the one that came out, it was dated September 23rd, and there is another one, and in that letter, does it state?
Ms. German, I've only seen the one on the 23rd, and reasonable opportunity is talked about in, I believe, paragraph 4 on the second page.
Okay, so to your knowledge, then, there isn't a second one out there. We had heard a news report that that one would come out, and
I haven't seen one.
The facts straight. Because as I read that, in fact, yes, the reasonable opportunity language causes concerns, and it says the proposal risks creating new conflicts with ANILCA, but I don't read that as saying, you know, because that language is in there, it's will not and cannot be certified. Just wanted to make sure we didn't have a second letter out there.
The second letter was in reference to the governor's proposal, and it's dated September 24th, an analysis of HGR 201.
And is there language in there that relates to that? I don't have a copy of that in front of me.
I do.
No.
This isn't dealing with reasonable opportunity. This solicitor's opinion basically says we have reviewed the proposed House Joint Resolution number 201 referenced above submitted by the request of the governor, and in their judgment, it's fully consistent with Title 8 of the NILCA. So that's what that second one is.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Murkowski. I don't believe the committee has a copy of that.
Put it in the record if you want to make
comment. You are correct in your earlier assessment that what the solicitor does say is that the proposal risks creating new conflicts with ANILCA. So we're again at a quandary whether it does or does not.
Mr. Chairman, on that point,
Representative,
and may I just again state that that was one of the agreements that was reached 2 years ago with the secretary, that he would carry that amendment forward to as an amendment to ANILCA at that time.
At that time.
Mm-hmm.
What changed?
At that time.
We screwed up. Are there additional questions at this time?
Well, a midnight deal would be made.
No further questions. Oh, there is one. Representative Hallgrove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Julie, there is obviously, this issue predates me by, about 20 years. There is some concern that, and I've heard it since we've been down here, that AFN has not moved and has not compromised. And I would like you to possibly address that, if you could.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to address that. I have also heard that and read that. In our land claim settlement act, as I had testified earlier, there is a section in the conference committee report. While Congress did not deal with specifically with subsistence in our land claim settlement, there was a section in the conference committee report which stated very clearly that the Congress expected the Secretary of Interior and the state to deal with the legitimate subsistence needs of the people. And that, as well as there are several other issues that weren't dealt with our Land Claims Settlement Act that got put off. It was in the period of time from 1971 until 1980, there was really kind of unrealistic expectations by the members of the Congress that the Secretary and the state would protect the interests, and it became crystal clear by the time ANILCA was being worked on in the Congress that there was a lot of problems in the state and there wasn't the protections in place. And so Title 8 of ANILCA became part of that process as far as the continuation of the commitment that was made in our Land Claims Settlement Act. Obviously, the Native people would like to have seen all our Native people around the state protected under a Native priority. At that time, you can look through the whole legislative history of ANILCA, and you will see all the issues that were raised during the whole ANILCA debates on all kinds of issues. And we have done legislative histories of that period of time, looking at every single conference report, every single committee hearing, all the range of issues, and I can't recite them all here. But there were many compromises that were made during that whole ANILCA debate on many other issues other than even just whether or not it would be a Native priority or a rural priority. Clearly at the time, there was not the support in the Congress to put a Native priority, and specifically at the request of the governor of the state saying, we don't have that ability in our Constitution to deal with the Native priority. Can you deal with a rural priority, and you could pull out Governor Hammond's testimony to the Congress specifically on that. So that I think that we can demonstrate that since prior to the land claims, there has been compromises made by the Native community. And I would also say in the past almost 10 years since the McDowell case has come down by the Alaska Supreme Court, the very fact that AFN and the Native community has been working with every governor since that case came down, from Governor Cooper to Governor Hickel to Governor Knowles, every single legislative session, every single special session, virtually I'd say almost every single committee hearing that's been held with the express purpose of trying to help the state resolve this issue, try to help the state try to regain management, to me is an indication of the great willingness that the Native community has, particularly AFN, since that is who I'm speaking on behalf of today, interest in trying to help the state. But I will also say that we are very exasperated, we are very disappointed that this issue has not been resolved, and we've gone through all these many years, and our people are ready for the federal government to come in and fully implement the federal law. You know, everybody's got only so much patience on that, and I think that our patience has just really evaporated, especially if you look at the situation of our villages that are impacted by the salmon shorting, the 102 villages that are in economic distress. The fact that they do not have the federal priority for subsistence fish at this point in time, when they're under distress, both from the commercial and the subsistence side, to me is an example of where this conflict between the state and the federal government, the conflict in the laws and the courts, hits, kind of the rubber hits the ground, is you're having people actually being impacted. And that's why I think you see that, plus the length of time that the state has not been able to deal with it, you can see why people are losing a lot of optimism that the state is capable of resolving this, and are looking more, hopefully, to the federal government. At least they'll implement the law, at least the priority will be implemented, at least there'll be agencies that you can work with to try to make this be smooth and workable. It is our hope that with all the work that we've been doing on the national level to raise the visibility of what's going on reaching out to friends and allies and people, that this legislature can rise to the challenge and resolve it and point out to the nation that Alaskans are able to resolve this. And we feel very strongly that you have a very short window of opportunity to do it, but it is very important for the future of the state that you do that you rise to the challenge and you resolve this and you get it out to the voters, and that it's a straightforward constitutional amendment that can help pull people together and restore a system in the state that's unitary instead of the dual management system. And I think that this constitutional amendment that's in front of you, with all the conditions, with the litigation, all this stuff, is nothing more than more division, more divisiveness. And if this is the vehicle that goes out to the people of Alaska, has no hope of pulling people together. It just makes things more divisive. All your terms that you stick in the constitutional amendment, so many of them are undefined. You're just encouraging massive more litigation and more fighting between Alaskans, between our government and people, between different interest groups on that. And it's really kind of a lawyer's field day when you have this kind of thing at a constitutional level. And that's where we're saying is come forward with something straightforward, well-defined, that meets the needs of coming into compliance, and don't add all this other stuff cluttered. I mean, there's tier one issues, there's tier two issues, there's tier three issues. There's a lot of conflicts and issues that need to be resolved, but they don't all need to be loaded up in a constitutional amendment. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Julie, I'm a little short on history, but can you just briefly tell me why during the negotiations back in the 80s, late 70s, when it all began, there wasn't provision that addressed subsistence for all users? I think I heard a presidential clip that kind of suggested he would protect subsistence for all the users. And I'm not sure if that's the correct statement, but it's something very similar, and I'm just wondering how the president can make that comment. But more than that, I'm anxious to hear the little bit of the historical aspect of it.
Mr. Chairman, it's actually sort of a long story.
Craig is going to say that.
And if you go back into the early 70s, the two laws that were on the books, 72 and 73, the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act, both provided for exceptions to no hunting for Alaska Natives who lived along the coast of the Bering Sea, the North Pacific, etc. And so there was a movement away from that as time went on. There were the arguments and the discussions in the middle 70s in the legislature were over the creation of subsistence areas in rural Alaska. And the increased pressure that was being felt by people in villages because of fly-in hunters, for example, which were really what triggered a lot of the activities in the bills by Senator Sackett and Representative Huntington in the mid-70s were based on hunting pressure into the Koyukuk and into the Holitna River and the driving out of local people from getting a chance to harvest. That's what was intended. That's when we got to the Northwest Arctic Caribou crash and the efforts that were made by the Department of Fish and Game to try to allocate a very small number of caribou that were remaining to just the people who lived in the region, and the inability to accomplish that because there was no statutory authority to do so, and then the lawsuits that tried to stop that kind of allocation from taking place. That built up to where is the problem, and the problem was that there was a lot of pressure being felt in rural Alaska from people who were coming in from outside of the area, whether they be from urban areas or even outside resident alien residents from other states or aliens who were coming in to hunt. And all of this pressure was building up, and people were looking for some way to address that. And that's pretty much how it started, because it was intended to address the problem of pressure in rural areas that was being felt that had not been felt in that way before. So this was all sort of a history that was built up to why, when the Congress took a look at it, they said, well, where is the problem? And we really need to address the problem in rural Alaska. Hope that's somewhat helpful.
I guess the first chapter. Further questions? Seeing none. Thank you for your testimony this evening. Representative Terrio, hold on. Don't go away yet.
Sorry, I was just in my office listening to the last comments, and I think, especially by using the proximity to the resource, we're trying to address just that problem where somebody from outside an area comes in and takes the resource. We want to try and reserve the resource in that local area when there's a time of the shortage for the people that live in that area. Conversely, I don't think, and I'm not supportive of wording that allows somebody from, say, the Tok area a preference to fly into the Yukon Flats to take the resource. If there is a shortage, it should be reserved to the people during that time of shortage, to the people of that area. And I think proximity to the resource gets you there. I think by just allowing a rural preference or place of residence, which allows a rural preference, it does allow that, what I believe to be unfairness, of somebody flying clear across the state to take a fish or game resource just because where they live is a rural area. So I don't know if that's incorrect. I'd like to...
Mr. Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, there are two qualifiers. There's two parts to the eligibility test for subsistence. The first is that you be a rural resident. The second is that you live within a customary and traditional use area that has been determined by, for the most part, the Board of Game or the Board of Fish. So if Tok people go to the Yukon Flats on a regular basis and have created a customary and traditional use in the Yukon Flats, then they would qualify. If they don't, even though they're a rural resident, they cannot participate in subsistence uses in the Yukon Flats. They can go hunting there, they can go fishing there under general hunting, sport fishing, personal use fishing. There's all kinds of opportunities, but they are not subsistence users in the Yukon Flats. Only the communities in the Yukon Flats, Chalkeetsuk or Fort Yukon or Rampart or whatever, that actually have those customary and traditional uses developed in that area. So there is a local aspect, a proximity aspect to it and to the existing system. Somebody from Angoon cannot go to Tutuliak and participate in a fishery on the Kuskokwim River as a subsistence user, only as a personal use user. And that's the way the system works. So there is no, the person in Angoon to Tuntutuliak or the person in Tok to the Fort Yukon area, the Yukon Flats, is exactly the same situation as somebody from Juneau or Anchorage or Fairbanks. They are in exactly the same spot. The only place that they have a priority, the only place they can even participate in subsistence, is in the area that has been delineated as the customary and traditional use area. So I just hope that clarifies Representative Terrio's point, and that there is a local aspect to this from the initial eligibility, not just at a Tier 2 situation.
You mean to tell me that that same village that's in the Tok area that would do their fishing or hunting in the Yukon Flats, if that particular resource were depleted for whatever reason, disease, whatever, and there was nothing left, that particular village could not, because of traditional use, could not go to another area under subsistence?
Correct. They could only go under general hunting rules. That's how the system works.
Mr. Chairman, is that...
I'm Sam Williams.
Is that the way that it's written in ANILCA today? Or is that according to the
That's the, Mr. Chairman, that's the statutory system that was put in place beginning in the late 70s, and that is how the law has been interpreted and implemented since 1978.
That's a state statutory scheme, then.
And the ANILCA scheme is done exactly the same way in the, now with the federal program for game, because there is a federal program. It was, that's how it started to be implemented. It's been implemented like that for the whole time.
Representative James?
No.
Further questions? None. Thank you again. Next, we'll hear from a representative from the Outdoor Council.
Don't think this is mine.
No.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dick Bishop. I'm Vice President of the Alaska Outdoor Council, a statewide conservation-oriented outdoor user umbrella organization comprised of about 10,000 members and 45 member clubs, including 45 member clubs. And I really appreciate your taking the time to, again, listen to our testimony. It is, I think, I would like to raise some points here, and I would like to, before I forget it, express appreciation for the work that the legislature has done on various drafts in particular, and trying to come up with this current draft. And it's pretty obvious from the discussion that it's not an easy task to unravel the legal implications of various terms, words, and their uses. But it is pretty easy to look over this latest proposal and realize that it does not meet the minimum needs to protect the interests of all Alaskans. And there are several needs that are associated with this, and I would, I guess, reiterate our concern that the legislature's principal objective should be to look out for the needs of all Alaskans, including their civil rights as well as their opportunities to use the fish and wildlife resources of the state and other natural, wild, renewable resources. And before I go on, I'd like to say that Dave Kallihaus is here with me to help with this, and I'm going to try to hit some general points, and we have had time to make an effort to suggest some improvements to this version, even though at this time we're concerned that it doesn't meet the needs of all Alaskans. There are some needs. As I've repeatedly stated on behalf of the council, it's not appropriate to have a discriminatory priority for the use of fish and game in the state, such as zip code. And that is, in fact, a discriminatory priority. And in this current version, proximity, if used by itself or allowed to be used by itself, in my opinion, will quickly lead to a succession of regulatory proposals that will be nothing more than local, rural, resident proposals. It is important that any treatment be subject to regulation, and the sustained yield language in here is important in that regard. We have recommended repeatedly that this priority be limited to fish and wildlife, that it not include all wild natural resources of the state. And the question is, which incidentally ANILCA demands, the question is, do you really want a subsistence priority on all state timber, or on all state berries, or on all state waters, or other things that might be roped in under the broad language of ANILCA, the very broad and loose language of ANILCA? And there I would find something to agree with the Attorney General on, that loose language is very dangerous. It's essential, we believe, that reasonable opportunity be included, so we're glad that that is there. We think it's essential that the priority only operate when there's an actual biological shortage, not a paper shortage, interpreted as being whenever there are regulations, as ANILCA now demands. We think it's important there be no commercial sale of resources taken under subsistence uses, and that it be required that it be non-wasteful taking, which is not mentioned in this case. And we do not believe it should be tied to an open-ended term such as customary and traditional, because that invites innovation and a host of the beginnings of new traditions, as well as the expansion of old. And it is, as the Bobby case indicated, whatever has been done in the collective past, if you adhere to the federal law. And we also feel very strongly that that a constitutional amendment relating to the uses of fish and game must be linked to passage of ANILCA amendments that retain or restore state authority on state and private lands, state navigable waters, and federal public lands. In the in the version before you, I can find the right one here in this pile. One thing you could do if you're intent on adhering to the dictates of ANILCA, there's a very interesting part of the findings here in section 801, number 2. It says, the situation in Alaska is unique in that in most cases, no practical alternative means are available to replace the food supplies and other items gathered from fish and wildlife, which supply rural residents dependent on subsistence uses. Well, the way the law is interpreted and the way the law has been handled doesn't do that.
and you've heard a lot of discussion about that, and I won't belabor that point. I would like to point out that Section 3 on page 2 amounts to the tail wagging the dog. And if you wish to include that in the effort to comport with ANILCA, which I think is not the correct undertaking for the legislature, then I think it ought to be made very clear to the people of Alaska just what they're getting in for. So it really ought to read that the purposes of the amendments proposed by this resolution is to provide for a preference for subsistence use of fish, wildlife, berries, timber, waters, and other renewable natural resources to ensure state management of fish and wildlife under federal law and federal court oversight throughout the state. So that it's very clear to the people, if they wind up with the opportunity to vote on this, that those are the terms of adhering to the federal law by amending our Constitution. And I would like to comment very briefly on Section 30, number C. If you wish to make it clear, if you wish to make some standard clear by which the governor could determine that the federal government has impinged on their authority, you could modify that to say something like, when the federal government enacts regulations for the taking of fish and game on state lands and waters, something along that line, but certainly make it much more clear. So I would like, because we have worked on this language in a minute, I'd like to ask Dave Kellyhouse to go through it. I would like to comment, though, on the issue of compromise, and I won't belabor it. It is best summed up for me, in my personal experience of 25 years with this issue, and I will paraphrase it, a statement from the Alaska Federation of Natives to the legislature, I believe it was in 1990, when there was a similar special session held to deal with the issue of conforming to ANILCA. And after much discussion and so on, there was a bill proposed, as I recall, or a constitutional amendment proposed, and we were in a position to hear and give testimony to the House Resources Committee under Representative Davidson from Kodiak. And Ms. Kitka said at that time that the Alaska Federation of Natives would accept no law that did not guarantee the survival of their communities and their cultures. And I thought that was a far-reaching demand, and I suggested in my testimony that the legislature should not accept that challenge because they were bound to fail. There was no law that they could pass that would fulfill that guarantee. And I have been associated with advisory committees, Governor Hickel's advisory committee, and I can tell you from personal experience that we went through long discussions and seemed to have reached agreement in 1992 in that particular case. Governor Hickel submitted a bill to the legislature that dealt only with state law that was a genuine attempt involving a number of different people from all elements of the public to improve the accommodation of subsistence uses in the state. And we thought that we had an agreement, but when the bill went to the legislature, it was effectively dismembered, not quite killed, but dismembered through the efforts of the proponents of the rural priority in the federal law. So I think it's been a mixed bag with regard to the issue of compromise. But in the best interest of trying to help you with your work, and we do think that this particular version inadequately addresses the needs of all Alaskans, we have worked on language for the principal part of the amendment, and I'd like to ask Mr. Kellyhouse to review that now, unless you would like me to answer some specific questions.
Mr. Kellyhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've made some copies of the section one that we worked on, and I have a few suggestions that may make it a little clearer and may address some of the concerns that Dick Bishop elevated. Now I'll wait till it gets handed around. There's may need to be more copies made, unfortunately. I didn't anticipate this many folks. The first change would be there is language in there, a phrase that says consistent with the sustained yield principle and sound resource management practices, but it's in the second sentence of the of section one there. I would recommend moving it to the first sentence to make it extremely clear that subsistence uses have to be consistent with sustained yield and sound management practices. And by doing so, you can delete it in the second sentence, so it doesn't add to the length of the amendment. The second question you must ask yourself, and we recommend that you put the modifiers in the third line of the constitutional amendment, put the modifiers fish or wildlife resource. If indeed you want to restrict it to fish and wildlife, if you want it to apply to waters and forests and other resources, at least make sure that's a conscious decision of this body. The next specific change we'd recommend would be to excise the words customary and traditional. In view of the Bobby case, it's those words are loaded, open-ended, and can be construed to be racial in nature, and we do not believe that there should be any probability of having racial language, or could be interpreted to be racial in the Alaska Constitution. We believe that the basis of direct dependence, proximity to resource, and the availability of alternative food resources would do that. We would recommend that you take the or out and replace that with and. We request that you consider putting in alternative food resources, and then characterize the priority to be limited to areas where the residents are characteristically dependent upon that resource for personal and family nutrition. I say that because of the presently we have non-subsistence areas, Kenai Peninsula, the area south of Fairbanks, most of the Matsu Burl, where subsistence uses are not characteristic of those areas, and it provides for a tremendous amount of hunting opportunity. If you don't have some language that protects those non-subsistence areas, you may run the risk of having subsistence priority in Anchorage and Fairbanks' backyard. The other thing we were thinking about was at the beginning of the second sentence, it says the preference may be granted only when harvestable surplus. Well, we thought perhaps the words the preference for non-wasteful, non-commercial subsistence taking would be appropriate there. And the last thing, everybody was trying to grapple with a shortage. George Udemal helped draft some language in the other body at the request of a member of that body, and that language is at the bottom. So in the last sentence, after the word when, the preference for non-wasteful, non-commercial subsistence taking may be granted only when, and then all the rest of that would be deleted, and then the language at the bottom of the page, when a historically unusual shortage of a fish stock or wildlife population occurs, until the stock or population of the resource has increased to a level that is consistent with the normal range of historic stock or population levels of the resource in the area, and with the habitat limitations for the resource. My original language simply read, when a historically unusual shortage occurs, the preference would be in place until that stock or population has recovered. But the attorneys added a lot more words to it. And that basically, we believe, would improve improve the product in front of you. If you wanted to retain the same language you have, you might, as the Attorney General pointed out, you may want to delete the second reference to reasonable opportunity, because it would involve the Board of Game and the Board of Fisheries making determinations that before they've never had to do. And I can't really see a point in it. But you might, if you wanted to keep that same wording, you could just say is not sufficient to provide for other beneficial uses. So those are some specific comments that, that may help you with this particular version of the bill, should you choose to use them. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, Mr. Callahan. I guess the first question I would have, you had the privilege of listening to the testimony of the Attorney General, but with this suggested language, do you believe that the intent of Title VIII is met?
I think the intent is, the intent of Title VIII to meet the needs of people that are dependent on wild food resources, I believe it would meet the intent. I'm not an attorney, but knowing the politics of this game for the last 20, 25 years, I bet the Secretary won't accept it. And we've said all along that if we're going to try to forge an Alaskan solution that's consistent with our Constitution and with our sustained yield mandates and such, it's going to require some give on the federal side. If your intent is to comply with ANILCA, well, you'd have to take the governor's version probably and just take all that that would entail. And if you want to try to forge an Alaskan solution, well, we're willing to help you to the extent that we can.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Mosterman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to the customary and traditional language that you think you're familiar with. I don't know if I heard you correctly or not, but you said you thought those words were racial in tone and shouldn't be in this.
I believe that the way they've been used now for the last 10 years, there's no doubt that they have been applied primarily for Alaska Native customs and traditions. And I think that's the public perception. That's the practical way they've been used. And I just think that the Alaska Constitution should remain colorblind to the extent possible.
Never thought of it that way, but I guess some people must.
I had the wrong parents, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Halcrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bishop, thank you for your testimony. A couple of questions regarding your comments. You had opened by saying that it's the legislature's responsibility to protect civil rights and opportunities, I'm assuming of gathering game. But as we heard from the Attorney General earlier, he talked about how basically society is replete with levels of discrimination. I mean, 16 to drive, 18 to vote, 21 to drink, 65 for Social Security. I'm sure that's what he was referring to, not to mention various income levels to